Today, does burnout economics equal stagflation? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. I'm joined again by Tarek. Hi, Tarek. How are you going?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. How are you?
Pretty good. Boy, we are in deep water now. I've got this vision of central bankers at the end of the Titanic as it sort of slides gently into the sea and looking a bit confused.
Well, I think that's quite a nice analogy, because we can sort of imagine Powell back in December when he was sort of very much doing his mission accomplished victory lap, like George Bush on that aircraft carrier during the Iraq War, you know, just saying, "Oh, you know, we've done our job. You know, rate cuts are coming up." And I think the thing is when the Titanic snapped in half, everyone on the part that was, you know, up in the air was thinking, "Well, this is actually pretty good. You know, this is actually going relatively well." But then it starts to sink, and then everything just sort of gets a little bit cold and miserable.
Yeah, exactly right. And I would say that there are a few other central bankers from other central banks around the place who would be joining him, right? Thinking, hey, my toes are getting a bit wet.
It's an interesting one, because the thing is, where the Fed leads, the rest of the world is forced to follow. I mean, we're seeing that a little bit today with the Bank of Japan basically, you know, releasing a nothing burger in terms of its statement, basically just relatively speaking, a commitment to the status quo, and the market not liking that, and the Japanese currency continuing to fall. And I mean, even if you look at, say, for example, into the developing world, in Indonesia, where they've seen currency pressures like, well, pretty much most of the rest of the world against the US dollar, they're raising rates because they have the scope to do so. And the question is, will that spread into the developed world, and will, you know, central bankers be forced into that catch 22 of, you can either, you know, deal with the stagflation, you know, or you can raise rates? You know, it's not a nice situation if that is the scenario that comes to pass.
Well, I think it's interesting, in the US the markets were betting on 6 rate cuts this year. It's now down to 1 if you keep your fingers crossed, right?
Yeah.
And of course, in Australia, you saw Christopher Joy's recent article, but he was saying, well, you know, rates could well be going up. And Warren Hogan's talking about 5.1% as the cash rate target potentially. So the world is changing quite fast, and the consequences of this are quite profound, which takes us right back to the burnout economics, which, of course, you've been speaking about for some time, which is effectively you've got central bankers trying to pull the brake whilst government is throwing stimulus. Of course, we've got, what, $20 billion of stimulus coming through tax cuts next financial year. We've got a budget ahead. And Chalmers, of course, after the inflation numbers this time around, saying, well, the numbers don't look too bad because it's still lower than where it was a year ago, without actually really recognizing that, of course, the base effects are actually helping, but not really.
I very much miss opposition leader Chalmers, because I genuinely respected the way that he looked at things, in terms of, like, he looked at per capita GDP, he looked at real wages, he looked at real outcomes, he looked at the, you know, the broader underlying themes going on in a data release, rather than just headline says this. And that's something that he criticized, you know, Josh Frydenberg for, and Scott Morrison for, on a relatively regular basis. And he was absolutely right. The thing is, he's doing the exact same thing now that Morrison and Frydenberg used to do. And I think the thing is, and we'll get to this later in the show, in the charts, but when you look at the breakdown of inflation for Australia, it's really not all that impressive. Like, 3.6% sounds pretty good, but when you realize how we've arrived at that particular juncture, all of a sudden you start to think, well, it's going to get a whole lot harder from here to get, you know, to get the next, you know, 1% or 1.6% worth of inflation down.
Well, and as I said, with the extra stimulus that's coming through from those tax cuts and the other little tweaks and things that are going on at the moment. And remember, of course, the inflation is artificially suppressed because of the government support for energy, for example, you know, because the numbers were actually a long way down from where it would have been if they hadn't been supporting that. And the question is, will they continue that next year? Because at some stage, they're going to have to withdraw that. And when they do, inflation bounces up. Rents, of course, continuing to be extremely strong as well. So, you know, when you look at it closely, the puzzle is quite difficult and complex to unpick. But I'm afraid that the political spin of everything's fine, folks, and, you know, we're going to give some more support to households doesn't cut the mustard at all.
No, and you make an important point. If we strip out the impact of the electricity subsidies and we strip out the impact of the increases to rental subsidies as well, then all of a sudden we'd be looking at more like just about 4% inflation in headline terms. And part of the problem going forward is that we're not completely mitigating the impact of rising electricity prices. We're just kicking the can down the road again and again and again and again. And eventually, it is going to feed into the CPI. It's just a question of when that ends up happening. And the problem is if Albo does extend the electricity subsidies, as some reports suggest that he will, for another year, all the way until after the next election, that will, in effect, suppress the CPI by about 0.2 to 0.3% in headline terms compared with where it otherwise would be. And that's a fairly significant sort of difference. If all of a sudden it's the difference between 2.9 and 3.2, then that's something that's, you know, that could really tilt things in one direction or another. And, well, but eventually we're going to have to pay for that. You know, whether Albo chooses to just take the hit now, or whether he chooses to take it after the election. Guess which one he'll choose.
Post the election. But of course, the other factor in all of this is the rental growth, which is stoked by very high migration. And the chances of them dialing back migration anytime soon is close to zero, in my view. So the rental numbers will still stay strong, and that's going to also feed inflation. So, you know, the inflation monster ain't dead. And just before we get into your slides, let me just to highlight the US data that came out overnight Thursday included, of course, a weak GDP, significantly weaker than people expected, but also the first version of the PCE. Now, this isn't the PCE that the Fed will go with, which comes out later on. But nevertheless, it shows that you've got stagflation in a time of weaker growth than expected, with stronger than expected inflation, which is the worst of all worlds.
It is, and I think it's really something that they achieved 1.6% annualized growth in Q1 with a deficit north of 8%. That's got to be some sort of record for failure outside of, you know, just outside of COVID, really, because I can't think of another scenario in which, outside of at least the depression, when they had such a large deficit but achieved such a poor result. It's really rather impressive in some ways, in a negative way.
Well, yes, you have to manipulate the figures in a particular way to make that happen. Of course, there's two other factors. That the high imports was actually one significant factor, and some people are stripping that out and saying, well, that's why it's low. And of course, the changes in inventory in the US are also a bit different from normal. So a few people are saying, oh, this is an artificially suppressed number, and therefore, you know, the true number is different. But the number is the number, isn't it? So there are market expectations now which have changed on the back of it. And interestingly, of course, the yields knock in on 5%, which is higher than it's been for some time. And those yields will feed through into, you know, significantly higher costs for all sorts of things. So we are in a really, really fascinating part of the cycle. And anybody who thinks that the inflation dragon is fallen over is, I think, well, badly mistaken.
Yeah, I think that the thing with inflation is that we saw a scenario where everything was very much priced to perfection, where that there was, you know, this immaculate disinflation, that inflation was going to come down without, you know, any sort of serious, you know, we'll not call it serious, we'll call it major economic repercussions. And obviously that hasn't really happened. And, you know, in the places where things have been pared back a little bit more, places say, like, for example, in Germany, which is running a much tighter fiscal policy than in the US, well, they've got a recession. So it's really a catch-22 situation of there are no good options. It's pick your poison.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there is no immaculate line of you know, being able to keep both the issues away and steer through. Interestingly, in the UK, believe it or not, the UK stock market has now reached a new peak, and everyone's now saying, well, maybe the worst of it's over here, and maybe that it'll be the Bank of England that cuts rates first. But we will see about that. I still think there's more water to go under the bridge there, and still a lot of market speculation and market expectations. But the interesting observation for me is that with this higher for longer narrative now very much entrenched, and with the higher yield costs, this is going to put big pressure on stock prices, because of course the future discounts of revenue will now be discounted at a higher rate, which means that the other valuations are huge. And it's interesting, Tesla's I think what PE at 59 at the moment. You know, some of the other Magnificent Seven are in the PEs around the 30. I think Meta is around 22, 21. So you can see there's quite a big range, but they're still, you know, over-egged in terms of valuation. So that says to me that the downside risks on the stock markets now are pretty strong too.
Well, one of the interesting ones for me is that if we do see yields continue to remain strong, we see growth hold up well enough on the, you know, just and we're amidst a backdrop of just higher than expected inflation, I think that creates a really interesting scenario in which all of a sudden a big hit to stock prices may actually be desirable for governments. Now, I realize that may sound, well, extremely counterintuitive, but at the end of the day, if it smashes down yields and it sends, you know, long yields back down to 2 to 3%, and short yields, you know, potentially even further, at least in terms of a short-term economic shock, all of a sudden servicing the debt, you know, you could in relative terms could halve compared with what it would be. And all of a sudden, that might seem like a relatively desirable option. Probably not right before an election, but afterwards, you know, then all of a sudden it starts looking like a real, you know, something that maybe, you know, doesn't look too bad.
Well, I think you've got to make a very important point there, because of course the markets up till very recently had sort of factored back in the Fed put, right? So the idea that if in fact markets were to drop, then the Fed would cut rates because they didn't want the markets to go backwards. I think that narrative now needs to be questioned. I think that because of the high inflation and everything else that we're seeing, they might actually welcome the reduction in prices in the stock markets, because that basically is a tightening factor, and they need a tightening factor. Otherwise, they're going to have to put rates up even higher.
I think that that's a really interesting sort of observation, just in the sense that, particularly here in Australia, that we have all these options to tighten policy. We have all these different options to drive down inflation, but they're not being taken. It's being left pretty much solely in the hands of the RBA. Well, it is being left in the hands of the RBA, let's be honest. And it's getting to the point now where I feel like, and we'll get to this in the charts in a few minutes, but I feel like we're getting to a point now where demand may potentially run away from the RBA to the point where we do potentially see that, you know, stagflationary scenario whereby at a per capita level, and particularly for households with mortgages and households who are renting, so, well, most people, they're getting, you know, in relative terms, crushed, while other parts of the economy are still doing, you know, relatively well on the back of, you know, whether it's government spending or just increased aggregate demand through population growth.
Absolutely. Makes a really, really interesting set of observations. And I think that is a great segue into the charts. So let's go there, shall we?
No worries. All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the charts are, as always, available at avidcom.substack.com, and we shall get right into it. Now, I got curious recently about the impact of population growth relative to the RBA raising rates. So what I've done here is charted the impact of the increase in population growth since the RBA started raising rates until the latest possible data that I have for each of the two data sets. One of them is from the RBA, which is up to December. The other one is from the ABS, which is the labor force data, which is up to, I believe, March. Now, what this basically shows is that for most of the last 18 months, the increase in household consumption driven by working age population growth has been roughly on track with the amount of money that the RBA had been taking out of the economy by raising rates and raising the amount of scheduled mortgage repayments. The thing that's interesting to me in this is that this is based on a very crude level analysis in the sense that it's just based on a level of per capita spending divided by the number of working age people, because generally speaking, the level of consumption for people under the age of 15 is more or less non-existent. Their parents do the consuming for them. But I think that this just shows that they've been pretty much balanced out against each other. But now that the RBA has stopped raising rates, this is going to accelerate away further. So we're going to see a gap open between the two, which is going to potentially put a bit more upward pressure on inflation, which is just a little interesting tidbit.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. The other observation is, of course, that some households will be able to spend more and consume more because they've still got savings buffers and they don't have mortgages or rents to pay. Other households, not so much. So the distributional aspects of this isn't actually necessarily reflected in this particular chart, but I actually think the distributional aspect is pretty critical because, you know, in my surveys, I'm seeing more and more households who are more and more underwater in terms of cash flow. But we also know that there are still other households that are doing actually quite well, and they've had the pay rises and they've had returns on their savings and investments still supporting them. So the distortionary effect in terms of the overall economy at a household level, I think is pretty profound.
It is, and I think that that sort of alludes, that was something that we alluded to a little bit earlier, just in the sense that there is that divergence going on. And part of the problem with pursuing, the burnout economics approach, whether it's using fiscal policy like the Biden administration to inject further cash into the economy, or whether it's the Albanese government's approach or the Trudeau government in Canada, whether it's their approach of using and increasing the population in order to keep up the keep up headline GDP and keep up economic activity more broadly, that basically means that it keeps all the plates spinning. And while you do manage to avoid a recession, so yay for that, it ends up shrinking the per capita slice of the pie. And I think if you want, as you said, if you get into those distributional issues, I would say that the slice of the pie going to the median person is probably shrinking significantly more than the per capita figure would suggest. So that I think is something that's quite concerning, because if for example we do continue to see inflation remain strong, stronger than expected. Now, while that's not something that I personally foresee, but it doesn't really matter. What if I'm wrong? What if the consensus is wrong? We could see a scenario whereby the continued growth in aggregate demand, particularly once we start seeing the tax cuts and whatever other goodies the government comes up with the budget flow into the system, we could see a scenario where rates either have to stay high, or as Warren Hogan and even Capital Economics, who reckons it's going to happen next month, personally I don't see it, but they're talking about rate cuts and relative sorry rate rises and relatively soon. If that happens, you're going to be crushing that proportion of the population who is impacted, but you're still going to be running aggregate demand to the point where the rest of the economy could be growing and even be growing to the point of it being inflationary. So it's a complete mess, really.
Well, let me be cynical for a minute. I mean, I'm not usually cynical, of course, but the Labour government needs 51% of the votes to get re-elected. So somewhere there's a bit of a calculation going on as to which households are actually being adversely impacted, which households will vote for Labour, and what they will try and do is to put together a package of support, particularly in this budget, but maybe another one later in the year too, to make sure that they can demonstrate to 51% of the population that Labour's good for them. That's what they're looking for. That's all they're looking for at the moment. It's a political stunt more than anything else. Never mind the long-term implications, and never mind the broader issues with regard to inflation overall. As long as more than half of the population vote for Labour at the next time, then they feel that they'll have won the argument. But in the process, they're wrecking a lot of things.
Yeah. Rather than getting bogged down in the politics, I'm just going to get onto the next slide because I've got quite a few to get through today.
Go for it.
Okay, now this is a chart of from the ABS of what inflation looks like in terms of the headline rate and the trimmed mean. So you look at it and you go, well, that doesn't look too bad. I will say that take it with a bit of a pinch of salt because one of the reasons why we saw such a huge blowout in the headline CPI is holiday travel costs in that last quarter of December 2022. And if you strip those out of the equation, and the RB and the ABS has admitted that there are some serious issues with that, and that's why they're part of the volatile items section of the monthly CPI now, that is one of the problems that they have encountered. Now, if we look at the CPI by category, you can see that on a quarterly basis, there are actually four categories that are in outright deflation: communications, recreation and culture, which is driven by falling holiday travel costs, furnishing and household equipments and services, and clothing and footwear. So I think that that makes a very important point that we have already seen outright deflation in multiple categories of the CPI. And that is how we have arrived at that 3.6% year-on-year headline number. Now, the thing I say to people is are we going to see further levels of deflation to that magnitude again to help us get down the next rung of the ladder? And short of some major economic shock, it's unlikely that those categories are going to fall this to the same degree that they already have. They're not going to be negative 4% without some sort of, the wheels have come off sort of situation. So I think that that illustrates nicely just how challenging it will be to, get over that extra mile. And, and then you look at what's actually contributing to inflation these days. It's the stuff that you need. It's healthcare. It's education. It's insurance. It's housing. It's all those things that you really need. Where and not only that, I think it's also just worth noting that furnishings, household and equipment services, that is very much driven by household appliances and household furnishings being deeply deflationary. On a more normal, even keel, that would be slightly inflationary. So if we do start to see things return to that more even keel, then that's upward pressure on inflation, not downward.
A couple of observations. Firstly, if you look at it from a discretionary and non-discretionary element, actually the non-discretionary elements from an inflation inspected respect inflation perspective are down, but the non-discretionary ones continue to be a lot stronger. So in other words, the things you have to buy are actually inflating more significantly. The other interesting observation, if you look at particularly the audiovisual goods and those sorts of things, prices of those are roughly where they were. They haven't moved that much. But if you look at the analogs in like the US or other areas, they've dropped significantly, somewhere between 17 and 25%, depending on where you look at the data point. So there is potentially some gouging going on in that particular sector of the economy in Australia. And once again, you saw it with some of the supermarket data. Well, I suspect that the computer and audiovisual element is also where a lot of people are recovering a lot of margin. So that's another reason why, these inflationary numbers are a bit wobbly. And of course, the other factor is they did some further reweightings. And guess what? They did more reweightings towards the travel and those sorts of things and away from building and construction and a few other bits and pieces as well. So you sort of sit there and think, well, hang on a moment. Some of these reweightings are also, pulling the numbers in funny directions. Despite that, the inflation number's still very strong.
Well, I think the thing is, even if you look at, say, like a category, say, like recreation and culture, if you look at, say, some of the components of that, if you think about, say, for example, like a trip to the footy, if you think about a trip to the movies, when was the last time you saw deflation in either of those states? When was the last time, your hairdresser got cheaper or your vet or whoever? Like those services are not getting cheaper. And, eventually the downward pressure that we're seeing from these temporary bass effects are going to fade, and that is going to put a bit more output, not a huge amount, but it doesn't need to be a huge amount. I think that's really the sort of key theme in all of this. It doesn't need to be like, 6, 7, 8%. If it's hovering around sort of, 3.2, 3.5, that's still too high. Now, whether or not the RBA will cut under those circumstances, if things start to go wrong in the labor market, well, that's another matter.
Well, but the unemployment rate was, rather surprisingly lower than many people expected, and below what the RBA was forecasting. They will publish some new forecasts in May when they do their next release, and it'll be quite interesting to see whether they revise anything or whether they keep it as was. And I saw some commentators saying, "What's all the fuss about? It's still pretty close to what the RBA was saying." But it is the mix. It's the mix of inflation and the reasons why inflation has come down, which is so critical, right? Because they will not be repeatable. And so there are other categories that are continuing to go the wrong way. And I guess if we go to the next slide, you can then look at the tradables and the non-tradables, because that's another way of looking at the problem.
Yeah, exactly. No, because what we've got here on the left is tradables, which is basically imported goods and services. Now, how can you import a service? Apparently, you can. If you go on holiday overseas, that's importing a service because reasons. On the right there, we've got non-tradables. So that's things that are consumed and made domestically. So I think that really just illustrates quite nicely that inflation on that count, especially if you look at the little quarter on quarter, but bars on the graph on the right, it just shows that it bottomed out quite a while ago. So I think that we've got this sort of situation where there's very much two fights against inflation going on. In one, it's going very, very well. And in another, it's not going so well.
Yeah, well, I would argue that the tradables is all about the healing of supply chains, which of course were significantly disrupted through COVID and post-COVID, and they've sort of got back to a more even keel now. But the non-tradables is homegrown inflation predominantly, and that's wages growth. That's where you see the very significant rise in insurance costs, for example, and some other factors too. They're the ones that are homegrown, but they're the ones that are out of control. And just to reiterate, the tradables adjustments, which were supply chains healing, well, they've now healed. So you wouldn't necessarily expect to see further significant drops in the tradables ahead. And the little bars begin to sort of show that there's been a turn. If that continues, then the net of inflation overall is going to be pretty painful, which then takes us right back to, so will the RBA need to raise rates rather than hold rates or even cut rates?
It's interesting because today the PPI came out, which is the producer price index, and that came in hotter than expected. So we're starting to see a bit of a resurgence in producer prices, and that's something that I think is quite concerning because at least if you look, say, for example, in China, places like that, the sort of manufacturing hubs, things are still relatively deflationary in that regard, but not on the domestic front, which is a bit concerning. And not only that, but we've seen some rises recently in commodity prices, which could really begin to complicate things once more. So it's a very challenging set of circumstances. And I think that's something that you and I have been talking about now for a while, just in the sense that it's not so much that there's like this big, huge thing that's going to keep inflation high. It's a lot of little things. And it's also the fact that the deflation or the disinflation story, the deflation story, or the whatever you want to call it, it's predicated on a relatively narrow set of circumstances continuing. And I don't know if you've all noticed, but we've got a few wars on and some quite in, you know, s some rather, serious geopolitical, shockwaves. So, expecting that things are all just going to be, maintained as, sort of like late 90s immaculate disinflation, then it's quite a little bit more challenging than that.
Yeah, and some of the international agencies like the IMF have been talking about some of these risks and these elevated risks and how they could propagate through. And oil prices, of course, have tended to be higher rather than lower, and could go higher ahead. The gas price shot all over the place in Europe quite recently because of what was going on with regard to gas stores in Eastern Europe and also some of the other issues there with regard to supply. So lots of uncertainties, and uncertainties in the context of higher inflation for longer. And I just want to come right back to your fundamental thesis here about the burnout story, which basically is you've got fiscal and monetary pulling in two different directions, and that elastic is getting tighter and tighter and tighter, right? Something's got to go ping at some point.
Yeah, exactly. It's either that or, something breaks on the car and then all of a sudden you've got a recession, which is, well and truly possible.
Exactly.
All righty. Now, this is a chart from PropTrack on the costs of a new home, in particular, new home construction. Now, if you look there on the left, you can see the output costs for both houses and other residential, which is townhouses, apartments, units, etc. And you notice that they're both experiencing an uncomfortable bounce. And I think it's worth noting that that isn't something that has happened during these previous large drawdowns in demand. This is something different. And this is also reflected in the ABS numbers for new home construction costs, which have been bouncing around now for the last three quarters between 5 and 5.3%. And if they do sort of get stuck range bound in that rough sort of area, that's going to make it a lot harder to kill inflation. When you've potentially got rents and housing, and say let's throw in council rates and home maintenance accounting for like 1.4% of the headline CPI by themselves, and I'm talking about percentage points, not percent of the total, so that leaves 0.6% at the bottom, to keep it between around 2%. So there's not really a whole lot of room for error in that regard. And I think that is really the main theme in all of this, is that it just doesn't take much to tip it in that wrong direction.
Yeah, my analogy would be, you've got this very narrow path with, sheer drops on either side. But unfortunately, the width of the path is getting narrower and narrower and narrower. And it doesn't take much to be able to slide down one side or the other side. And at the moment, if you look ahead, it looks to me as though the path is pretty much disappearing in the distance, but getting so narrow that it's very unlikely to be able to traverse it for much longer.
It's gonna be interesting, I think, because we've got these very different competing narratives coming from government, coming from the market, coming from analysts, etc. And I think the thing is, that like it was still a lot of hope that we were going to see this immaculate disinflation, that things that were just going to work out, nice and easy. And I think it's really starting to sort of come home that maybe we won't. And I think the thing is that when you and I talk about these things, it's not like we talk about the sort of consensus as if it's impossible, because it's not. It's nothing is ever impossible. But I think that the part of the problem with the consensus in recent times is that it just hasn't had that room, that margin for error, that something might happen somewhere in the world, or that maybe they just might get something wrong a little bit. It doesn't, and I mean, I think that's one of the big things as well. Like, say for example, like the US core PCE, core CPI and super core CPI, the most recent print, that wasn't off by a huge amount, but a couple of percentage points can make all the difference.
Yeah, and of course it's all accumulated over time. So, the deviation from where they thought it was going to be can be incrementally small each month, but it takes you further and further away from being able to actually, get back on track. It's interesting, I don't know whether you saw, there was a tweet, I can't remember who put it up there, but somebody said, well, it looks as though rates probably aren't going to get cut anytime soon, but most of the economists were all calling it wrong. Wonder why that is. Are they in groupthink land or whatever it is? And in fact, if you look at the markets, you'd have to say that expectation of rate hikes, it's not totally on beyond even Australia now.
No, and that's a good Nice little segue into the next slide. This is a chart from which AMP put out today, and all of a sudden we've gone from pricing in quite a few, more than a few rate cuts by September and December, to all of a sudden we've got half a rate hike priced in for September, half a rate rise. We had rate cuts priced in, I should say, half a rate rise priced in for the September meeting of the RBA. Now, I'm of the view that we'll see the labor market weaken, which will sort of put a bit of a kibosh on this. But if somehow that doesn't happen, then it's well and truly on the table if inflation remains resurgent and, we struggle to sort of make the progress in the inflationary in the CPI categories where we need to.
Yeah, and the yields, of course, in Australia are also higher than they were, which is a bit of a proxy for where rates might go. One of the reasons why mortgage rates are sort of sticky higher than perhaps a lot of people expected. Interestingly, I've had probably five or six people send me communications either via social media or email saying, "Well, we were holding on. We've got a mortgage that is going to effectively switch from fixed to variable over the next few months," and people were talking about between June and the end of the year or next year. So we were banking, they said, on the fact that rates are coming down. So we weren't worrying too much. Suddenly, we're getting quite worried because if in fact the mortgage rates stick around where they are or even go higher, then that's going to be a huge impost. And of course, there was a recent piece of analysis in the, I think it was the RBA bulletin that showed that there's still quite a lot of people on low fixed rates that are still to switch to variable rates. Now, those variable rates potentially could be quite a lot higher than had been factored in earlier on. So this is going to be yet another drag potentially on households.
Indeed, and I think that it's something that's interesting is, you and I have been talking about people who have been finding themselves in difficulty for a while now. And we've both commented on the fact that you've got various different, support and hardship programs that that we basically didn't have last time we had a serious, rate rise and, sort of recessionary-esque conditions. And I think the thing is, how many people are using up their rope in those sets of circumstances who are, in hardship, who have taken the payment holidays, who've done all these different things in order to keep, the wolves away from the door? How much time do those people actually have left? And realistically, if the market is correct, and if we're not going to see rate cuts until February or later, or we might even see rate rises, are these people going to be able to take that? And I think that there is arguably some sign that in some cases the answer is no, in the sense that if you compare the new listing numbers for properties being listed for sale between Sydney and Melbourne and the other major capitals, they're like chalk and cheese. Melbourne and Sydney are both seeing normal, not much more rapid normalization of stock, whereas the other capitals are still off in la la land with low levels of stock. And that's something that has occurred in New Zealand, which is now, which they saw that immigration-driven rise in property prices, which now they're starting to see, more property hit the market. All of a sudden, those property price rises are petering out in a lot of different places.
Yeah, well, the scenarios that I've always been looking at included one where rates stayed higher for longer. As a result of that, more people got into difficulty and the pressure to sell just grew. And of course, the balance between supply and demand is always the tricky part with prices. But in some markets, we're already seeing Melbourne, of course, is leading the way down at the moment. So even the indices are showing no price growth on aggregate in Melbourne, although the aggregate doesn't really tell you that much compared with some other markets. But it'll be interesting to see because, of course, it's Tasmania that's had the most significant falls more recently in the value of property, whereas Adelaide and Perth and Queensland, particularly around Brisbane, have been quite strong. But it could change. And it doesn't take much to sort of mix the supply and demand the other way, and there's a self-fulfilling feedback loop as well, because of course, if people think that prices are likely to go backwards rather than not, that might bring forward prospective sales, which has a self-perpetuating negative feedback loop. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. I think the next 6 months on property prices will be really, really interesting.
It's an interesting sort of, just like what you mentioned, just in terms of the psychology and the perception and stuff. I think that's an interesting one in particular for Melbourne. Like, if you look back at, say, Perth over the last, let's call it, 12 years, that paints a very interesting picture of, the last tail end of the boom into, the falling prices in nominal terms and, the relatively, sizable falls in inflation and in wage adjusted metrics. And I sort of wonder if that is potentially going to be Melbourne's future. This is, just thinking out loud here, just like, we are still seeing those, less than favorable migration flows compared with the way it was. Melbourne used to be, prior to COVID, was the mecca for, migration in per capita terms, and it was quite popular in terms of that internal migration as well, whereas these days not so much. And I mean, I think the thing is that perhaps it's masking things. Perhaps it's because there's more Melburnians heading off up to Queensland or up to the New South Wales coast or whatever, but it just doesn't look as favorable as it once did. And there's a reason why, by some metrics, Melbourne property prices are at roughly sort of, 2017, 2018 levels.
Yes, and let me just make this point, because if you look at the default rates, guess which state has the highest default rates?
Victoria
Western Australia.
are still the
Yes,
hangover.
and that's the point. These things take a long, long time to work through, right? So, the latest mortgage-backed security data show that the highest level defaults are still in Western Australia. And I suspect that it can take 3 to 5 years for this all to work through, because of course people, muddle on and try and get by. But if prices do begin to fall and you start getting negative equity scenarios, that leads you into difficulty later. So everybody who's talking about the Perth market being absolutely booming at the moment, just bear in mind that the default rates are highest over there too.
That's an interesting one, because it just makes me think just in terms of what exactly is going to happen in terms of the psychology of people who do have these big mortgages, who do find themselves unable to pay them, and they do see their equity of, sort of evaporating. Like, this isn't the US post GFC, where rates have been crash dived, you could refinance your mortgage to, just on, all very nearly untold level of low rates, as long as you could qualify for the credit. We're in a very unique situation here where we could see rates high for a protracted period, and people are potentially in a scenario where they're going to be watching their equity evaporate. And that, to me, that's going to be an interesting one if that does end up coming to pass. Because the thing is, so much of this comes down to migration. Like, I'm honestly, God's honest truth, I'm sick of talking about it. I'm sick of it conceptually. But at the end of the day, it is just the key to this, because if Melbourne does get another 150, 170,000 new arrivals from overseas in net terms, then yes, that's obviously going to help support the property market. But if it magically went back down to, say, I don't know, let's call it 60, 70, 80,000, different story, very different story. And then, you're talking about a completely different ball game.
Yeah, well, I had Leif Van Onselen on the other week on my show, and again, he's very, very strong on the key to all of the economic woes we have at the moment is the high migration. And we can't build enough property, we aren't building enough infrastructure to support people, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, the migration story is the one that you've got to actually address first. And then he went on to say, and of course, if you address that, and also the energy problem, where the high gas prices are actually leading to much higher energy prices than it should, those two levers would actually take us into a very different future But of course, those are politically unacceptable things to deal with. So it comes back ultimately not just to economics, but to politics. And you know, the levers that are there potentially to help alleviate some of the inflationary pressures are those that are politically unacceptable.
Yeah, pretty much, unfortunately. I wish I had something more meaningful to add to that, but that's a pretty good summation.
Yeah, it was pretty good. I'll put the link below to the show. It was a live show, and he was really coming off his long run.
Oh, he gets fired up, but he's well and truly on target. I'm a big fan.
Absolutely. Okay, next slide.
Okay, now I was going through the various demographic data for Australia because I wanted to look back on what proportion of first home buyers were getting into the market relative to the overall, relative to the overall first home buyer, you know, sort of demographic, which is historically the 25 to 34 demographic. At least that's how CoreLogic defined it. So I figured they've done their data, I'm going to do mine, I'm going to go back further. Anyway, what I found was something really, really interesting. The population of Australia between the ages of 25 to 34, between 1991 and about 2006, barely grew. It grew by less than 2% across that entire time. It was remarkably stable. And I think that there is an argument to be made that that is part of why, during the late 90s, before we saw the capital gains tax in discount introduced and the doubling of the first home owner grant and those other stimulatory policies, why property prices were affordable. But what we've seen now is we've seen an absolute explosion in the number of people aged 25 to 34, and ergo people of home buying age. So it's not really surprising that when you increase the size of a potential first home buyer cohort by 35%, and I will note that this only covers until the end of 2022. This doesn't include the big, huge rise in migration seen in 2023 and 2024. So it just goes to show that when you increase the competition for something so significantly, and not only that, but during that time, we've seen, since the very early 2000s, we've seen the housing turnover rate fall from over 9% to about 4.5. So it's halved. So we've increased the number of prospective first home buyers in this cohort by 35%. But at the same time, we've more than halved the amount of stock available on the market for them to buy. And what happens? It's, you know, it's year nine business study stuff, you know? And you look at it and you go, it's obvious, you know? I mean, it's plain as day. I mean, to be honest, I didn't personally see this coming to this degree, but there it is.
Yeah, this is a very telling slide. And, you know, just to reiterate, the significant acceleration away and the continued acceleration, and that goes right back to the discussion we had about high migration, of course, bearing in mind that the natural growth of population is much, 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 much lower. So this is where the migration story really intersects with the property story. And a lot of those people aged 25 to 34 end up, of course, in the rental sector, which is another reason why we're seeing significant pressure, particularly on the rentals. A lot of these could well be also students because the temporary migration numbers are way, way, way higher than previously. Of course, the universities want to argue for more student migration to support the economies of the universities, never mind whether it actually supports the economy of the country. But this is a really, really big and important factor. I think you've put your finger on here.
Yeah, it's kind of, I was a little bit shocked, to be completely honest with you. I was not so much shocked that we had seen such a huge ramp up, but just the fact that of growth was just so non-existent for so long prior to that. And you know, I think the thing is, you know, when young people say, and when not even just young people, when non-homeowners say it's harder to get into the market, there's more competition to get into the market, there's less stock relative to the level of demand, They're absolutely 100% definitively correct. It is just true beyond the pale, beyond any sort of reasonable level of criticism, that it's just concrete data right there. All you've got to do is look at the turnover data and look at the population data, and hey presto.
Yeah, and I think this also explains why we've seen the proliferation of tent cities, because younger people and perhaps individuals or small family units are capable of living in tents, certainly in the short term. And for me, the blight on Australian economy and on Australian society from these tent cities is writ large in the failure of government policy over many, many years. This chart of yours explains why.
Yeah, I think, like they recently, I think it was like back during, the pandemic, it was like, it's really helpful if you've got, your parents to help you buy a house and stuff like that, like that was, sort of one of the deciding factors. And that's absolutely true. But I think one of the things that has just gotten disturbing is just how that sort of reliance on parents and, older people for young people has just, accelerated and deteriorated, in the sense that it's like, if you can't find a rental, you better hope that you have a damn good relationship with your parents, because otherwise it's dodgy, potentially dodgy share house if that's all you can find, or it's tent city, and that's just an absolutely absurd situation to be in. And this isn't like, and I think the thing is, like, people on welfare benefits have been in that situation for years. That is not a new thing for people in those circumstances, even for people on, on sort of casual and low paying, minimum wage jobs. I mean, it's horrible to say, and you and I have been talking about this for a long time, but it has been the reality. But these days, you're talking about people who are on full time, roughly median full time incomes, who can't get homes. And it's just ridiculous, and I'm going to stop myself there before this turns into a 15-minute rant.
Probably wise, because we have covered it before, but it does show you how dramatically severe this issue is, and many people are actually caught. What about the employment story? Because that's also another angle on this, isn't it?
It is indeed. Now, it's a mess. The data is a mess. If you were to look at the data in January, you would have thought, wow, we are knocking on the door of a recession. Because if we're only creating 7,000 jobs a month and we need 30,000 to 40,000 jobs a month just to tread water, yeah, we've got a problem. In December, we got a problem. March, well, things are looking up. And if you look at the participation rate, all of a sudden, the participation rate is lower. So all those people are no longer present in the labor force as they otherwise would have been, and ergo, unemployment looks better. So it's a bit of a mess, to be honest. And I sort of foolishly, put stock in the ABS data in, December and January, thinking, well, this looks pretty dire. But frankly, I still think it looks pretty ordinary. If you look at all the various other indicators, they're all pointing to weakening jobs growth outcomes. But the ABS says things are looking pretty good. So
Yes, well, the numbers of available jobs, and particularly some categories, have come way back from where they were. It looks so. In other words, the supply looks a little different from where it was, and that would suggest that some employers are not hiring so fast. In fact, in some, they're actually seem quite easy now to get the people that they need. I think there are big issues. Big, big issues with the ABS data on the employment. But it is interesting to see that similar problems exist in the US, exist in the UK and other places too. And it's partly because the ability to get good sampling data seems to be a problem. Maybe it's because of the methodology that's used, but also there's significant revisions And some of the US data, of course, the revisions have been quite remarkable, right? Seeing the the employment numbers. So bearing in mind this is such a critical element within the overall story of how you measure an economy and therefore how you measure the impact of inflation and those things, the fact that the employment data is sus is a really big issue because you haven't got a compass.
No, I mean, like I've spoken to a few economists about this, sort of, off the record, and the general consensus is that unemployment is about 4.1, 4.2%, somewhere in that range. And, we're talking 3.8, 3.9 with the ABS. Now, while that may not sound like a big difference, when Bullock's line in the sand is about 4.5, that makes a fairly significant difference. So it's really quite a bit of a mess. And I think in some ways, if this does end up, if we do end up, having this conversation in 12 months and it's revised and it turns out everything was much worse than it appeared, I think people are going to have every right to be pissed off with the ABS because, things justified a very, very different policy response, to the one that we're getting.
Yes, well, I think the ABS is partly responsible. I think the RBA is partly responsible because of their policy mistakes in the past, and I don't think they've stopped making policy mistakes. So those two institutions, are basically sitting there steering a lot of the decisions. But if the basis of the decisions are actually a bit suspect, then we could be actually making policy errors. The trouble is with policy errors, you don't know on day one that it was an error. You've got to wait to see how it plays out, which means, of course, that water has to go under the bridge. It means that perhaps unemployment will rise, which means that more people will have difficulty. And only later will then they say, oh, actually, well, maybe we didn't quite get it right. But of course, then they don't tend to want to admit that they actually got it wrong. So that's the other part of it, isn't it? There's little accountability here.
I think the thing as well is that, like, if the choices do come down to, in the end, in hindsight, to eat a recession or not, or eat a recession now, or eat a recession later, I think this is going to go down as a fairly sizable mistake by the Albanese government. Not just a sizable mistake, a huge mistake. Choosing to instead grow the labour force by an additional, let's call it 300,000 people a year, per year over multiple years, expanding the labour force to that degree. And then ending up eating a recession anyway, and you end up, having the unemployment line being, even potentially larger as the economy sort of shrinks and reverts to a more sort of streamlined and efficient, because I mean, that's what happens in recessions, deadwood gets cut and you end up with a, leaner, meaner economy. But the problem with that is that you end up with the same leaner, meaner economy in relative terms. And it's not that much larger to be able to justify the expansion of the labor force to that degree. So you end up with more people unemployed, more migrants potentially having to go home because they can't find enough gainful employment and work. And I think that's part of the problem with all of this is that, it's all predicated on this idea that, oh, it's great for migrants. I don't see how it's great for migrants to be welcomed into this absolute fusterclock of a rental environment, and that's all something that we should all get behind, and sing kumbaya.
No, well, I agree with that. And interestingly, of course, in New Zealand, because New Zealand was also running very strong migration, they've actually started to make decisions to try and dial back the migration part of the story, even as you said a little while ago, the property listings story there has changed quite interestingly.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. We should probably get through these last few slides if we can. Speaking of New Zealand, you're getting good at these segues, Martin. Me, not so much. What we've got here is total homes for sale, which are currently around about 2016 levels. And if we look at the prices in some areas, they've started to drop off. In particular, in Auckland, they peaked about 5 months ago, and they've now sort of trended sideways to maybe down slightly. Now, at first, I thought that was seasonality, but the sort of duration of the move has sort of made me reconsider that particular viewpoint. Now, I think it's worth noting that it is different in some locales. Some are still performing quite well. It's very much similar to the situation with Sydney and Melbourne versus the other larger capitals and the regional areas. They can also be quite disparate in terms of outcomes, but yeah, it's interesting. And The question is will prices fall further as the Kiwi economy continues to sort of hobble along in, sort of quasi-recession mode?
Well, of course, bear in mind that the cash rate in the US, is higher, about 5%. Same as in New Zealand, right? Our cash rate is significantly out of kilter with most other Western economies. And you can see there that the higher interest rate in New Zealand has created some of the issues that we've been talking about. The sort of recessionary forces in New Zealand are stronger. And now we're seeing it coming into the property market. So the really interesting question is if Australia does put those rates a little higher to try and tackle the sticky inflation that we're now seeing, will that then flow through to the same extent as we see in New Zealand now, where listings rise and therefore property prices begin to ease back? I mean, this is another of those precarious, twitchy situations. But our cash rate is significantly below others. Now, of course, there are people saying, well, that's because we've got a higher proportion of variable rate mortgages, so the impact is more significant. That's true. Even New Zealand has a higher fixed than variable. But nevertheless, it seems to me that Australia is out of kilter in terms of cash rates.
I think one of the interesting things in all this, and like we were talking about earlier, that migration is the key, but the question is, what happens to the property market if the worm really turns? If the labor market turns, we start to see rising unemployment, we start to see people heading, temporary migrants and stuff starting to head home, and all of a sudden, we do start to see some degree of normalization, at least in some locales, in terms of rental availability. Now, a broader national salvation for the rental crisis, that's going to take, outside of, a major recession and exodus, is going to take years. But in some locales, in particularly places like Sydney and Melbourne that are already on that sort of tipping point, the question is what could happen in that regard? And I think that that is, it's just something that is really key to all of this, just in the sense that if we didn't have this level of migration, there is not wouldn't call it zero chance, but a very low chance that we would see the property market that we do today. I think it would be much, much more like the way it was prior to, the impact being felt, sort of like, let's call it late 2022, early 2023, a downward march, but not at an especially fast rate. And the question is, what happens when things eventually do return to normal? We've seen the market artificially first propped up by low interest rates, they're gone. And what happens when, the high migration driving things ends up, being resolved in time as well? I mean, what happens to property price capital growth? As all of a sudden, you start to see, the tables turn and, the balance tip in the other direction.
Yes, well, if the wealth effect goes into reverse, and of course, over the last little while, a lot of people have actually felt more wealthy because property prices have risen. One of the reasons why the Bank of Mum and Dad still exists is because people had equity in their properties that they could share. If it starts to go into reverse, two things happen. One is the cash purchases from Bank of Mum and Dad disappear. Secondly, the downward draft starts to capitulate and multiply, and it can start dropping quite significantly. We saw that in some other countries post 2007. Now, I'm not saying it's necessarily going to happen, but again, in my scenarios, one of the scenarios I do run is just this one where you actually tie back migration, rates stay high for longer or go a little higher, and property prices do fall. And unfortunately, in some areas, they could fall quite significantly, which then destroys wealth, which creates its own problems. So I think we are in a very precarious situation, just at the moment. And coming right back to where we started, with this sort of risk of stagflation, with the risk potentially of interest rates higher, it's all to play for, isn't it, over the next little while? So there was plenty to talk about when we have our next show.
Oh, definitely. There's, I think the thing is, you see these data releases and you go, huh, I'm definitely gonna have to talk to Martin about that. And I think what ends up happening sometimes is there ends up being about six, seven, or eight different things, and it's just we can't even get through them all in a day.
No, we'd have to have a 24/7 show if we were going to cover everything that's going on at the moment. But we give a good fist of it, you know, once every couple of weeks. And I want to appreciate once again all the work you put into the charts and everything and the conversation. And we'll do it again in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, sounds good, mate. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Take care. See ya.
See you, mate.